Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond.
And I'm Claudia Wu. We're the founders of Cherry Bomb Magazine. This season on Radio Cherry Bomb, we're thrilled to share recordings from the Cherry Bomb Jubilee. It took place Sunday, March 29th, 2015, in Manhattan.
This was the second annual Jubilee, which is a one-day conference with some of the most amazing, inspiring women in and around the world of food. This next segment is a very exciting one. It's an interview with the person everybody wants to be their best friend, Ina Garten, the Barefoot Contessa. Interviewing Ina is the writer Julia Tertian, a good friend of ours and the host of the first two seasons of Radio Cherry Bomb.
The excitement level was off the charts when Ina walked in the room. Introducing Ina is Bobby Brown, the makeup artist, entrepreneur, and number one Ina fan. Enjoy the conversation and thanks for listening to this special episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
So I'm happy to be back here at Jubilee again this year. I had such a great time last year meeting everyone. But I'm here today to talk a little bit about this incredible woman. Now, those of you that know me, my beauty philosophy is really simple. What you put in your body has a lot to do with how beautiful your face is, but also important is friends, family, food, entertaining, and just being comfortable with yourself. And where did I learn this from many years ago? When I was a young makeup artist, I happened upon the Hamptons, and in the Hamptons was this store called the Barefoot Contessa. I went in the store, and I just saw the most incredible food, and this was back when we did not have all these cool gourmet stores, and I discovered a woman named Ina Garten. And what's amazing about this incredible woman is she has really taught so many women, my generation, and now she's teaching so many other women of your generation, how easy it is to live a full, rich life. She's an amazing woman who really is a pioneer. She's has broken so many rules. This is someone that was working in the White House and said, I'm not really happy. With the support of her husband, she opened up a business in the Hamptons, without any formal training, and she opened up the Barefoot Contessa. Now, 9 books later, an incredible TV show, she has taught us all how important it is to live a really full, wonderful life. There's nothing I would like better than to be invited to her home with her husband and my husband and my kids to have a wonderful meal. And one last thing, never in a million years did I ever think I'd be up here introducing anyone who used to be a nuclear policy analyst under Richard Nixon. So here she is, this amazing woman, Ina Garten. Thank you.
Well, first, thanks to Bobby for that great introduction for Ina.
Thank you, Bobby.
And thank you to Carrie and Claudia and everyone who put together this day and putting us all together in one room. It's a great day. In preparing for this conversation, I was thinking about, I don't know how many of you were here last year? Oh, wow, that's good. That's great. So I don't know if some of you might remember, there was a great chef, Katie Button, who is here, who talked a lot about just many things and very articulately. And she mentioned how much women tend to overuse the word lucky. And a lot of women who were on the panels were saying, you know, they got to where they are in life because they were lucky. And she pointed out that maybe we're leaning a little too much on this word. And there's a lot that goes into a successful person. And there's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of dedication. There's a lot of passion. And so that made me think about you. And I was thinking about when we as readers and viewers of your show look at you, you're making like beautiful food. You seem to be quite relaxed. I think we forget.
Seem to be is the critical detail.
Behind the scenes. There's a lot of structures in place to create the content that you make. So I thought today we could spend some time really actually not talking about food, but about all these things that you've built so that you can make this amazing food and show us all how to do it.
I'd love to.
So that's the plan.
Can I just first address Lucky, and then we'll go to that? Or are you going to address that?
Oh, please.
I think it's really interesting, because I think women do feel lucky. And part of it is that we didn't expect to be doing what we're doing. We expected to grow up and have a much more traditional role. And I think it's wonderful that we feel lucky. A lot of what's happened in my life was luck. Maybe I did something with it, but I was also lucky it was at the moment when food was happening. Especially food store business, as Bobby said, didn't really exist when I started. And so I was really lucky it was the moment and that I'd had, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell says, a lot of experience when it came into it. I'd done a lot of cooking at home. But then I was lucky that Food Network came to me. I said no to them for years, and they just kept coming back. So, I mean, that was really, there's so many things that are luck. That I feel really strongly about, but it also, you know, but then it takes hard work after that.
But to identify those moments and take advantage of
them. And also to appreciate how lucky we are, to starting with that we're living right now. If we'd been living 50 years ago, I assume all of us in this room wouldn't we be doing exactly what we're doing. Yeah. So I just... Well, and enormously grateful for that.
I want to take a step back a little bit, not quite 50 years, but a little less than that. Bobby pointed out you started your career in food like so many entrepreneurs in the White House.
Oh, yeah.
not really a linear...
I actually don't go quite back to Nixon. I go to Ford and Carter. Just one step
I was going to say you look early. Great.
I look great for somebody who worked for Nixon.
So let's talk about that moment when you saw an ad for a store that was for sale somewhere where you did not live.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that moment, because food was something you enjoyed at the time. Did you imagine it would be your career? Did you want it to be? Did you know it could be?
I knew I didn't want to work in an organization, and I got to be I was 30, and I was reading the New York Times, and there was an ad for especially food store for sale. And I knew I wanted to have my own business, because every time I'd work in an organization, I thought, if they made me the head of the organization, would I be happy? And I thought, not really. So I knew it was something that I needed to be mine, that I needed to get up in the morning, make my own decisions, and see if they worked. And that was what was going to do it. And I was always interested in cooking. So I taught myself how to cook while I worked in the White House.
That's great advice. I was actually talking to a friend who's not in the food world, who hates her job. Yeah. And I asked her if she were to have her boss's job, would she enjoy it? And she was like, no. And I was like, well, then get out of here.
Then you're on the wrong job. I think it's a really good test. And the other test is, do you get up in the morning and go, oh, I can't wait to, you know, I go on vacation and I just can't wait to come home. I mean, because I love the people that I work with. We have a wonderful time. I'm not saying every minute of every day is something I want to do, because if you don't take care of the business part, you don't get to do the fun part. But all of it together, I absolutely adore.
Yeah. I think you write about that a lot. And I found a line in the introduction to your very first cookbook. You said a friend gave you advice not to think about what you're supposed to do, think about what you enjoyed doing as a child.
Yeah.
And I promise I won't mention you too much, Jeffrey, but in your Paris cookbook, you thank Jeffrey, I believe in the acknowledgments, for encouraging you to do what's fun first. Is this your guiding principle for career decisions?
Well,
what's
when
fun?
I think about Barefoot Contessa, fun, and I have kind of a list of words that I think about in terms of, is this something that we should be doing? And fun is the most important. I think there's a wonderful quote from Oscar Wilde. He said, work is easy, fun is hard. And, I mean, we all know how to work, but actually finding things that are fun for us is hard. So I've always felt that if what I'm doing is fun for other people, they'll be attracted to it. The store was fun. You walked in, the screen door slammed. The sound of it felt like summer. There was coffee or hot apple cider that you could help yourself to. There was a huge bakery there. Pastries were, there were samples out. The music was cranked up. It was probably Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett or something old-fashioned. And everybody was happy there. I hired people that were happy, because you can teach people about cheese, but you can't teach them how to be happy. So fun is a really critical part of everything I do, both consciously and unconsciously. And at the end of the day, it's fun for me too.
that's what we could, you know, the most we could all ask for. I actually, on my way in today, I hope she doesn't mind me pointing this out, but I met a woman who's here, I believe from Washington, D.C., who used to work at your store.
Yes, that's Bettina, exactly right.
So Bettina. we can cross-check.
Did we have, I don't know where Bettina is, but did we have fun? Did we have fun? We used to work all day and then have parties all night. I was like the ringleader.
I want to take a minute just to share some statistics that I got courtesy of your publisher, and Kate, who's here from Clarkson Potter, helped me to prove just that going through life, you know, choosing the things that are fun, that you enjoy, that make you want to get out of bed in the morning, you've made these choices, and these choices have come with a lot to really congratulate. First, the most impressive thing I've ever heard, you have over 10 million books in print.
That's pretty amazing.
That's an amazing number. That's really...
That's pretty amazing. Thank you.
Your latest...
That's fun.
Yeah. I like your fun. Your latest book, which is your ninth, Make It Ahead, spent a very impressive 17 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
Wow.
Just going to embarrass you a little
bit more. I'm really embarrassed now.
You're the recipient of 2 Daytime Emmy Awards, a James Beard Award. You're up for one, I guess, next month. And a Goodreads Choice Award and a Matrix Award. And then lastly, I thought important to include things that don't have numbers or prices attached to them. You seem to really love what you do. You seem to enjoy your life. And I think that counts for a lot.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
looking back, did you have any of these kinds of awards or numbers or anything like that in mind? Were these goals when you started writing?
I never do.
No.
I never do. Because what's happened has been so astonishingly better than what I could have imagined that I don't even bother. I just think I get up every day. Actually, Bobby Brown was saying this. I get up every day. I just do the best job I can possibly do that day, and then I go home and have a good time. And it just builds on itself, and I just do it day by day. And things come across, you know, people ask me to do things, and I go, not interested. I mean, somebody asked me to do, to endorse a line of fertilizer. I was like, fertilizer? You want me to endorse your shit? I was like, no. And then every once in a while, something like Food Network comes along, and I go, I don't think so. But then I start thinking about it, and I go, well, okay, that's actually interesting. If I can make it fun, if I can work with people I love, and I'm doing what I love doing, then maybe I'll try it and see how it goes. So I kind of keep in my own space and just do absolutely the best job I can do, and I never think about the money, and I just always feel like the money follows that. So... And if you do stuff for money, it never works out.
Yeah. Agreed. Is there anything professionally you haven't tried but you would like to, even just to dip your toe in the water?
Well, I can't think of anything, actually. No. I mean, I know a lot of people ask me about doing restaurants, but I think that's really hard work. Where you're, I'm a morning person. I think working late at night is hard. And I loved the specialty food business because it was actually during the day. We went home at night, which was great.
It's a good schedule.
I can't think. I mean, I just can't believe I get up to every day and I get to do this.
And you don't have to go very far to
do it. No, exactly. I think Jeffrey actually is at Yale, and he gets up on Monday morning and drives 4 hours. And he likes to call me and say, "So, how was your commute to work, dear?" Which is like from one side of this room to the other. I have the house and then the barn where I work right across the lawn. I'd like to tell him that the rabbits were in the way or the lawnmower.
All these obstacles.
All these obstacles to getting to work.
Yeah. Speaking of sort of setting up your workspace, just really literally like in your backyard, I want to talk about some other logistics and the sort of structures I mentioned earlier that help you produce the content you produce. I want to talk about your team, which we touched on a little bit. You started in food with a small store. It was, I think, 400 square feet.
It was 400 square feet. I actually bought an existing store that had been going for about a year, and it was 400 square feet.
And you had 2 employees?
I had 2 employees. One cooked and one worked in the store.
And then the store grew
to
thousands of square feet.
I moved it across the street to a 2,000 square foot store, which was too big for me. So I had others, like somebody made pasta and had a produce store there, and Barefoot Contessa.
And what was the max number of employees you ever had?
Between catering and then I had 2 stores for a while, so I had about 100 employees. Yeah. One between catering and I think that was just the store. And then in addition to that was people who served at parties and things like that.
Yeah. And now you've come sort of full circle. You're working in a smaller space. You have your own sort of handful of employees that work.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you know this, Julia. When at some point, after I've been doing this for almost 20 years, I thought it was kind of time to just shake it up. I knew how to do this, and I wanted to just find another cliff to jump off. And so I sold the store to 2 employees, the chef and the manager, and I sat around for a year. A friend had said to me, type A people think that they can change their jobs
while they're doing something, and they can't. They have to just stop, which is why I did this. And I built myself an office upstairs, and I just said, okay, what am I going to do next? And I have to say, the hardest year I've ever had in my life, because I just couldn't figure out what to do next. And I thought, well, you know, my major career is over. That was, especially food store, it was great, but I need to do something else. And a very good friend had actually quit her interior design business at the same time. And we used to sit around and go, okay, let's see now. I don't want to have any employees. I want to do something I'm really excited about. We want to do something, I mean, you have to make money, otherwise it's not a business. And we want to be able to drop everything and go to Paris at a moment's notice. And we would, like, fall over laughing, like, that job doesn't exist. And she ended up being an artist, and she teaches classes in Provence. And I ended up writing cookbooks. And I mean, I don't even see myself as having employees. I work with people I love. And we just have a great time together. And I'm lucky enough that I can drop everything and go to Paris once in a while.
Sounds like pretty great criteria.
So I just, yeah. I had that little checklist for myself, and I thought, well, that's never going to happen. But I think once it was in my brain, it just somehow worked out.
So your goals have been sort of driven by the kind of life you want to live, as opposed to money, numbers,
well, I think
stats.
You know, when you choose your profession, you choose your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very important, I mean, we all choose our professions because we love it. But, you know, like as a food stylist, you're traveling all the time. And I don't love traveling that much. I like being home.
No, it's okay.
So the lifestyle goes with whatever you're doing.
Absolutely. And do you have any, I mean, sort of leaving one job before either starting a new one or creating a new one, taking that time off? I mean, there's so much value in it, but it's also, it could be hard to do, especially at somewhere like New York, where it's very expensive to live.
It was really hard.
That kind of thing. What's your, you know, maybe we can't all take a year off, but if someone's taking a month off, say, what's your advice during that time? Because that can be a scary moment when you're figuring out.
It's very scary, because I just didn't know whether I would figure out what was next. And my friend said to me, you're going to have to get really good and bored before you actually start, because you have to start. I mean, we all stand on the edge of the pool or the pond and go, I don't know, it might be cold in there. There might be fish in there. There are all kinds of reasons not to jump in the pond. But until you're actually in the pond, you have no idea what it's like in there. And when you're in there, you might go, oh, that's interesting over there, and do something else. But you have to get in the pond. Yeah. And so what happened was, there was one day about, I don't know, must have been 9 months after I'd sold the store. Jeffrey, who was leaving to go to Yale on Monday morning, said, so what do you have to do today? And I said, nothing. Absolutely nothing. And he said, we must have something. And I said, I have a manicure on Wednesday, but that's it. And he said, you need to figure out what to do. And you love the food business. Stay in the food business. And so I thought, well, I'll write a proposal for a book, thinking I would never be interested in doing it, that I wouldn't be able to do it. But at least it was something to do. And I just got step by step by step. Just made a proposal. It was accepted, to my shock. And I just thought, okay, at least I'll have something to do tomorrow. And it just led to this incredible life that I never would have imagined on day one.
Didn't you open a savings account to put the advance
in?
Because you thought you would give it back?
I thought, they gave me an advance. I thought, well, I'll be giving that back because I obviously can't write a book. So I put it in a separate account thinking, well, at least I didn't spend it. I can give it back to them.
Is that account still open? Do you
know? I think I closed that account by now.
I'm happy to hear that. What you were talking about reminds me of a very short sort of kind of embarrassing story, which was I was at a career moment where I didn't quite know what was next, and I didn't know if I was comfortable where I was, and one of the things I did was go to a psychic, and I thought maybe
a psychic, that's great.
Can't hurt, right? And so I was there almost as a doctor, like complaining about, like, oh, I feel scared, I feel anxious, I feel all these things, and then he told me to stop fighting the box and stop being scared of being stuck in the box and just get comfortable in the box.
Oh, that's
interesting. And then life will go on. And that to me was like, it sounds crazy, but I held on to that for a long time. So,
and that really worked for you.
So I thought I would share.
That's great. it's kind of what it is to unlock that box.
Yeah, it can be a little scary. So I want to get back to those logistics. So I know you don't necessarily want to call them employees.
And can I just say also for everybody, if it's not scary, everybody would do it. Mm-hmm. So it's why you actually are unique. If you're willing to take, I'm willing to work really scared, and I always think it's not going to work out. It's just my DNA, the way I was kind of brought up, that it was going to turn out badly, and it always turns out better than I can imagine. So it's part of what you need to do is work scared. work through being scared.
And it's okay to be scared.
It's okay to be scared, yeah. It's actually, I think it's that nervous energy that actually works. Somebody told me that on TV. when I saw one of the shows in the beginning, I said to her, God, that wasn't actually as bad as I thought it was going to be when I saw the actual show. And I said, just think when I'm relaxed, it's going to be even better. She said, not necessarily. It's my director. She said, that nervous energy actually works on TV.
Oh, that's interesting.
And fortunately, I'm still scared. 12 years later.
What else scares you in your work
Everything.
Life? Everything. So you're running on
it would be a shorter list of things that don't scare me.
That's so funny. How many, yeah, you don't have to call them employees, but the friends that you work with, how many
people work with me? I have a woman whose name is Barbara Liebath, who works 4 days a week. She's worked with me since my first book, which is 15 or 16 years. And Lydie Hoik, who's right here, who does social media, came to us about 2 years ago, just under 2 years ago. I have an accountant who works. Yeah. And so that's it.
And so how many more people would you say there are, like, in the village? Like Kate?
In the village. Yeah. Well, I have incredible editors at Clarkson Potter. Kate Tyler, who's here, is in charge of public relations.
Who's the nicest, like, publicist I've ever met.
Smart, gorgeous, and nice.
I'm just going to add that.
The best.
There's a lot of nice publicists here.
Beyond wonderful. So my editor, Pam Krause, and Aaron Wenner at Clarkson Potter, all those people. And then there's a whole Food Network family. Mm-hmm. I have a production company from London, who's just incredible. It's called Pacific, and they all come from London, and we film together, and we're actually going to L.A. next week, in 2 weeks, to film in L.A.
Terrific.
It'll be fun.
I think it says a lot about both you and all these members of your team, both your sort of core team and your extended family, that you have worked together with the same people for so long.
From day one.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that I get along with everybody. I really think you're either on the train or you're off the train.
Yeah. How do you?
And I'm very. It doesn't bother me if somebody's not on my train. They can go on somebody else's train. It just they need to be part of the team, part of the family. We need to have fun. We need to do a really good job. Otherwise, you're off the train.
Yeah. I want to get you a little hat.
So it's not like I'm what?
I want to get you a little hat.
It's I don't like fighting with people.
Yeah.
I just don't. And I always it's my job to have a vision of what we're doing and then let people do a really good job within that vision. And it's my job to keep the train on the track.
And how do you do that? How do you keep everyone motivated and inspired? Because I feel like when
I start with people who are really motivated. Yeah. And we all, I mean, Lottie knows, we every morning, Barbara, Lottie, and I get together and we go, okay, this is what we have to do today. Okay, do you want to cook today or do you want to work on social media? This is what I need to accomplish today. Barbara will bring me letters from people that she didn't know the answer to. And we just, in the morning, between 9 and 9:30, figure out what we're doing that day. And then we all go do it.
That's great.
So,
and where does that meeting take place?
In the barn. Yeah.
That's great.
Tough life.
So if
we drink a lot of coffee. Yeah.
if kind of the biggest part of getting this team motivated is to have the right team, what do you look for when you're hiring someone?
Happy people.
Happy people.
You know, teach people. Happy people that are really motivated and care about quality. It's a basic, and obviously if you're interested in food, I mean, if you're interested in car mechanics.
That could be useful.
I don't know, you never know.
What are things that you absolutely don't delegate? What happens in your work life that only you can do?
Probably too much. Every single recipe I make over and over and over again. To make sure it's right. I make it for my friends. I make it for Jeffrey. I test it again and again because every time I work on a recipe, I change something. And then I hand it to Barbara Liebath, who's a good home cook, and I watch her make it. And she does something I never would have imagined. And actually now we've gotten, after 15 years, Barbara's actually too good a cook. So now we give it to Lydie and she cooks it. And it's just great to see what somebody young would do with a printed page, which is how... I mean, it's what in California they call the user experience, how someone's going to use that printed page.
to make what it is that they want. And Lottie has questions I wouldn't have imagined, which is so important to me.
Do you, during that sort of cross-testing moment, and I'm going to get sort of cookbook nerd moment, do you, are you guys talking, or are you just letting them follow the recipe? Like, are you saying, actually do this or do that?
No. I let them follow a recipe. Okay. I actually did something once. I took a friend who wanted to learn how to cook and went to the grocery store with him, because I needed to know, I mean, half of it is, do you get the right ingredients? So I gave him a recipe for pesto, and because he wanted to make pasta pesto, and I was going to show him how to do it. So he went, and he got to the basil, and he said, is this dry or is it fresh? And I went, oh, that's really interesting. It never would have occurred to me, because I know what pesto is. So from then on, I always wrote fresh basil in the recipe. So each time, I add details that will help. Obviously, most people know that pesto is fresh basil, but for those people that don't, there's the question is answered right there in the recipe. So, I mean, in answer to your question, there isn't anything that I don't get involved in. I mean, I sit side by side with a book designer, and we choose the colors and the font and the where the photograph goes, where the recipe goes, where I'm going to sign the books. Every single detail is, I do everything. Yeah. And we do it as a team.
That's great. I was reading an interview a couple of days ago with a very extremely smart, very prolific Seth Godin, and he said something in response to a question that reminded me so much of you that I wrote it down for today. And he was asked what content that builds trust looks like. And his response was, I think that it's human, it's personal, it's relevant, it isn't greedy, and it doesn't trick people. And this got me thinking about you and the way you relate to your audience, which I feel I can speak sort of firsthand because I follow your recipes and I watch your show. And I turn to your books and your recipes because I trust you. And I know that if I'm going to, you know, follow a road you're leading me down, I won't get lost.
Thank you.
Totally deserved. does this trust that you've built, because that's hard to do and you've built it so well, does this trust influence the way you make decisions, whether it's about how much detail to put in a recipe or whether to take the fertilizer endorsement deal or, you know, something like that? Does that come into play? How often are you thinking about
it? I do. I always think of myself as the customer. What would I want? And I remember many, many years ago, it's when I first started Barefoot Contessa, I remember thinking about, I was buying coffee to sell in the store, and somebody said, I wanted Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee, which was very expensive at the time. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just get Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee style. And a customer said to me, why did you do that? And I thought, why exactly did I do that? And I took the coffee and I threw it out in the dumpster, and I got Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee because it's the real thing and it's true. And if I wanted Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee, I want the real thing. So I have, you know, like the ingredients in the recipes, I want them to be ingredients that you can find in Kansas or Oklahoma, but you can also find them in New York and California. I want them to be really good ingredients, and I want people to feel that I've done the best job I can and that you can trust that recipe is going to work. I mean, it doesn't stop people from substituting sardines for chocolate, but what's on that page, you can trust. Then I'll never trick you into thinking one thing or the other.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
That's
really, I think it's good for any business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's true.
No, you set the bar very high for those of us who write recipes.
Because that's what I want.
Yeah.
I'd want.
Yeah, that's terrific. Where do you write? At a desk? In bed? Do you?
At a desk. And I'm always trying to find where the... I mean, I always think when I sit down, writing for me is the hardest thing in the world. You know, the introduction or the introduce to chapters. And I always think I have absolutely nothing to say. So I sit in a place that makes me happy, which is the big long table overlooking the garden. And I just sit there and stare at the computer and go, I have nothing to say. And then I say, well, maybe I have one little thing to say. And I just start, and the next thing I know, it's done. So I don't trust the process, but I find a pretty place to be. So.
And what time of day do you usually do that, or is it whenever you can?
After I've cleaned out the closets, emptied the dishwasher, written all my emails. Yeah. And usually by the end of the day, I have nothing left to do, so I write.
Yeah. That's my wife, Grace, is here.
Isn't that the way everybody writes?
Grace knows when I have a lot of writing to do, because I do all the laundry, I do all the
exactly. Day. I go next door and do their laundry, anything to avoid writing.
I think I might have to start cutting the grass. I might get into it. You basically essentially work from home. Your sort of office, your studio where you shoot your show, you do your cookbooks, is on your property. How do you turn off? How do you put work aside? Or do you? Or
I don't. I mean, I do. I do to some extent, but I'm always interested in the things I'm doing. And when I actually, for many years, I worked and wrote cookbooks and filmed in my house. And at some point, I thought, this has to stop. So, or Jeffrey's going to divorce me. So that's when we built the barn next door. So it is nice to walk away. You know, when the film crew's there, I can walk away when we're done and go home. Yeah. So it is, it's a real luxury. I'm
very aware
of that.
It's good to shut the door on that.
It's good to shut the door, exactly. But I mean, when we're traveling, I'm always thinking about things that would be interesting. Going to markets and looking at, I mean, sometimes the fashion in Milan in the stores inspires the colors of a book. So it can, you know, inspiration can come from anywhere.
Yeah, your recipes come in a full package, so there's a lot to think about. The photographs, the design, the TV, you know, all that.
Which is fun.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, just sort of quickly, on being active on social media? Do you think it's necessary? Does it excite you?
Or
you?
Well, that's one of the things I have to say. I was late to social media, and at some point, my publisher said, you have to do Facebook. You just have to. And I was like, I'm busy. I don't have time for this. And then I thought, okay, it's just like that pond. You can't say you don't want to do it until you're in the pond. So I said, I'll do it for a year and see how it goes. And I think it's absolutely fascinating. I read all the responses, or at least as many as I can. I think it really keeps my brain active looking for something. We do a blog on Facebook every week, and it keeps me active thinking about, oh, that would be interesting to do a blog on. Oh, that would be interesting. So I think it takes me places I wouldn't have gone. And then maybe, what would you say, when did we do Instagram? Lighty said, you have to do Instagram. So I was like, oh, yeah, I need something else to do. I'm obsessed with Instagram now. I think once it's in your brain and you're conscious of it, it's like a good friend. You're thinking about what they're doing or what's going on. I love Instagram. It's one of the first things I do every morning is see what's on Instagram, what my friends are doing, I follow a garden site because I'm interested in gardens. I follow food sites. Do you feel that way about Instagram?
Oh, totally, because I think especially...
It's so visual.
Yeah, and essentially both of us work from home with, you know, you have a small group. I've got my dog and my cat. Yeah. And, you know, you're working on producing
content.
And you
have a construction project now.
Yeah.
This is great to follow Julie on Instagram.
There's a lot going on. But you're producing work that you're hoping other people will read or use, and I think social media is a great way to just engage with people just directly.
It's to engage
amazing,
with people, but also to engage myself. Like when I was on vacation over Christmas, I just every day I thought, let me just find one thing that's really interesting to put on Instagram. So if people come here, they'll find something interesting. So it became a little story, and it actually motivated me, which is what I like even better.
No, that's great. I always think about your analogy of, like, you know, the pond and, you know, who knows what's swimming in there and stuff. I just think you wouldn't jump into something, like, you wouldn't jump into water if you didn't know how to swim. Like, you know you're going
to
be okay.
They're the basics. But I also knew that I could jump out if I didn't like Instagram or Facebook. I could get out. But it has been absolutely not just interesting to do, but incredibly effective in terms of reaching customers. And possibly what you were saying about young audience, which is just great.
I've got one more sort of serious question for you, which is, you've managed to build this very successful career doing things you love. And is there anything specifically that you do to maintain that? What I'm asking is, how do you manage to keep your work, your passion, and not turn your passion just into work?
I can't say that I do anything to keep it going. I'm just really interested in this. Mm-hmm. And I hope it doesn't end. I hope I can keep doing it for as long as I enjoy it. There's been no diminution. After I'd written a few books, I thought, okay, I've written all the recipes I know. I can't even imagine how I'm going to do the next book. And I remember saying to Jeffrey, I've kind of scraped the bottom of the barrel on this one, and it was only two books. And somehow over the next few books, it's kind of like exercise. I find I could sit down and I have 100 ideas for recipes for a next book. It's just gotten easier and easier. So you never know until you do something what it's like doing it.
And you have to get to the bottom of that barrel to see what's underneath
that.
Because there's no other way to find it.
I don't think anybody want to look underneath that barrel.
Because we're not doing audience Q&As today.
Oh, okay.
Speaking of social media, I did a little bit of digging on Instagram and through email.
I love that Julia does that. She crowdsourced questions, which is so interesting.
I thought I could be a little bit of a bridge between the audience and you today, and just before we go to lunch, ask you a few questions. The first is from Kari Stewart, who is here today.
Where's Kari?
Kari's right here.
Hi, Kari.
Kari is my friend and also my agent. And she would like to know, and this is very apropos considering the last panel, what's your go-to dish to make for guests who have special diet needs, say celiac disease and they're gluten-free? Or
you know, everybody has, I mean, now I always email people who are coming for dinner and say, is there anything you can't eat, or your friends or whoever's coming, because I only invite people I love. I want them to have something delicious. And what I never do is make two dinners, one's with wheat and one's without wheat. So I would make, for example, I would make what I want to make. And if there are people that are vegetarian, I'll make rack of lamb and three vegetables so that everybody can choose what they want. I always do buffet, so you can choose how much of what you want and what you want to eat. And then maybe if somebody can't eat nuts, I'll make the apple crisp without nuts in it. So I just tweak things so that it's good for everybody. And if somebody, maybe I'll make a pasta, orzo with roasted vegetables to go with the lamb. So if somebody can't eat gluten, then I can have the lamb and the spinach gratin and something else. So you can choose the things you like.
A little puzzle.
Rather than saying, okay, we're having this wonderful dinner, and you're going to have the tuna salad sandwich over there, which is the only thing you can eat.
It's good not to be left out, and it's good not to leave anyone out.
And that nobody even cares what you have. Nobody knows that your choice is different from theirs.
Yeah. Kristen Keene, who is not here today, has a question from her mother, so we're going to get back to her mom on your answer. Why do you prefer Hershey's semi-sweet chocolate rather than Toll House?
So interesting. I actually go back and forth. I think they're both great.
Great. Terrific. Carol Ann number one, that's her handle, wants to know, what's your favorite type of cookie?
Toll House. It's not Toll House. It's Hershey's and what's, is it Toll House?
Like the yellow package?
Nestle. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I do go back and forth.
What's your favorite type of cookie?
Cookie? That's a tough one. Actually, I think the salted oatmeal chocolate chunk cookies in the last book. Is it the last book? In Make It Ahead? Yeah, that's really high on the list. It's got sort of all that salt, sweet and salty. And
that's a good answer because you don't have to pick one.
It's like all the cookies. It's everything all together.
Sally?
Does it have cranberries in it too? No, just salty oatmeal, chocolate chunk cookies. I think it does have cranberries in it, so it's got everything.
Yeah, I love that. Sally would like to know if you would ever write a vegetarian cookbook.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's hard for me to think about not having chicken stock and things, but I've always had this idea that I've never come across a great vegetable stock. But I've always had this thought that maybe I would, because mushrooms sometimes have that meaty kind of flavor. Mushrooms with a little bit of sherry in it have that meaty kind of flavor. So it's in my mind, yeah.
That's great. So you can write the book, sell the stock. You're all good. Kylie, I'm not sure, asks the very hard question, Beatles or Rolling Stones?
Beatles or Rolling Stones? Beatles.
Jen E. Williams would like to know which brand of butter you use.
We usually use Cabot because it's available in grocery stores across America, but we sometimes use Land O'Lakes because that's also available. But yeah, those are the two go-to ones.
Lena Corwin, who's the author of Made by Hand, which is a great kind of DIY book, she's renovating her kitchen, and she would love to know any advice for a well-designed, functional kitchen, and you have 10 seconds to answer.
Actually, I can do that in 10 seconds. I think the biggest mistake that people make is that the kitchen is in the middle of the traffic flow in the house. So I think it's really important that if the back door comes into the kitchen and then you go into the dining room, that your workspace is out of that traffic flow. So everybody, like the cats and dogs and the kids and all your friends, aren't walking through your space. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, the stove, the sink, and the refrigerator are far enough apart that you have workspace in between, but you don't have to walk a mile to get there. Those are the key things. And two dishwashers.
Ooh.
I've been doing that for, like, I don't know, would you say 25, 30 years? And I can still fill up two dishwashers twice.
Next to each other?
They're on both sides of the sink.
Great.
And it's for me, it's just critical because I am the messiest cook.
I'm happy to hear that. I think that's good.
Really messy.
The last thing is not a question at all, so you don't have to do anything, but just a very sweet story I heard via Instagram that I just thought I couldn't not share, and it's from Mary Beth Shaddix, who's an expert gardener. She mentioned that she and a group of former Cooking Light colleagues, they have a standing Barefoot Contessa dinner party,
aww,
and they all bring dishes from your books and, you know, I think, go to different people's homes. And when she hosted, it was the Ina Garden Party, which I thought was just so great, I had to tell you. So thank you so much for being here. I would happily
so much
talk
fun
all day. But it's time for lunch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.